I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. A very special podcast today because we're coming live from CrimeCon UK, and I am Molly Wansell, as you know, and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell, and our special guest, who I'll let Geoffrey introduce.
Hello everyone, welcome back. It's a delight you're there. We're so thrilled. We have some wonderful listeners. I mean, all sorts of places. They're just so kind, and we've been meeting some of them today, and it's genuinely thrilling. But it's a different sort of podcast today because we've got a special guest. We've got Alan Johnson, once a Labour Home Secretary, among other cabinet posts, who's taken a little trip into crime, or shall we say thriller crime, yeah, fiction, with his book, The Late Train to Gypsy Hill, which I reviewed in the Daily Mail yesterday. Favourably, I'm pleased to say.
Yes. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been here.
Otherwise, you'd have gone home. But it's a delight. It's really very wonderfully idiosyncratic. It's charming. Well, Alan won about, what, 3 prizes for memoirs? I mean,
four, actually.
Four. Oh, okay. We're not bragging, no. A lot of prizes. And yeah, you really, I mean, you have great talent as a writer. Did you always know you had?
Not really, no. I knew I could string a sentence together when the books won the Royal Society of Literature Prize and all that. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't fiction. It wasn't an act of imagination. It was an act of memory.
Yeah, yeah.
It's my memoirs.
Sure.
So, you know, I couldn't, I to me, you're not really a writer until you develop plot and character. So, which is why fiction was the kind of rock face that was facing me that I wanted to climb.
Well, perhaps we should just, by way of an introduction, you should give an outline, not give the plot away, but give an outline.
Yeah. Well, so it involves Russians poisoning Russians in a London hotel, which might be familiar to you. It's not Litvinenko. It is fiction, but that was what gave me the idea. I was in cabinet when Litvinenko happened in 2006, but I was education secretary, so I was nowhere near the front line of all that. But I did wonder, because it was said at the time, and it actually this was borne out in the end, and the European European Court of Human Rights confirmed this last week, that he was in a London hotel, the Millennium Hotel, and he was served tea with polonium-210, a very, very powerful isotope. And I wondered at the time, what would have happened if the waitress got the order mixed up and served the poison tea to the would-be poisoner, which in effect would mean the would-be poisoner poisoned himself. That idea kind of coalesced while I was writing memoirs and all that. When it came down to fiction, I put some flesh on that. The waitress, who's a Ukrainian illegal immigrant, who mixes up the order, the guy who she kills, the would-be poisoner, Denis Smolnikov, his friends and allies, both in the FSB and in Russian organised crime, Krovni Bratia, which stands for Blood Brothers, don't quite see how easy a mistake it was to make. They want to talk to this waitress after the police have been talking to her. And on the late train to Gypsy Hill, she is on the train. This young innocent abroad, Gary Nelson, who's a 23-year-old guy who'd come to London for excitement and adventure and only found tedium and monotony as a working in an accounts department, in accounts payable in Covent Garden. And nothing had really happened for Gary. He was very reticent. He was not very good at, you know, chat up lines and all that. But he'd seen Arena, this girl on the train. And on this late train to Gypsy, we went and sat next to her, hoping to start a conversation. And as she's putting on her makeup, she's got a compact mirror and her mascara, she writes on the mirror, "Help me," and shows it to him, because there's two Russians on the train who she knows want to speak to her, that they're allies of Smolnikov. Now, from there on, Gary gets all the excitement and adventure he could possibly want. So it's a mystery, it's a thriller, and it's a love story.
It's a love story. At the heart of it. I think that what struck me about Gary is this kind of quiet, innocent, rather restrained, rather reserved. He struck me as like a character from H.G. Wells.
Like, well, you like, said in your review John Buchan, didn't you?
Yeah, but I did. Yeah, yeah. But actually, yeah, yeah. I because like. I thought yeah. most people won't remember who H.G. Wells was. Yeah, and yeah, they'll yeah. certainly never have read The History of Mr. Polly. yeah. But that there was that element of Mr. Polly, that element of a man who says, oh, I'm not going to stick with this anymore. I'm going to yeah. throw over the traces.
Yeah.
And he does in the most remarkable way.
But he had to be there to make this work. You know, with all this blood and thunder going on around him, he had to be the innocent abroad.
Yes.
Who had never been tested, didn't, you know, was a decent lad, working class lad. Once Arena seeks his help, he finds he's capable of all kinds of things
And in that respect, it's like Hannay, isn't it?
Yeah, Hannay
finds himself, what are the 39 steps? And you are gone, you know, he's on the Forth Road Bridges.
Yeah.
You know, you mean it's like this and... Yeah. It's that sense of being drawn into, yeah. which I think is rather delightful.
Yeah. Which at first he quite enjoys, but then as things get more gory, gets he realises what danger he's in and what danger Arena, who he's fallen in love with, the Ukrainian waitress he's in, can't really get out of it because she can't go to the police because she's an illegal immigrant and they'll send her back. Or there's a debate within the Metropolitan Police. There's a bent copper, by the way, which is nothing to do with my experience as Home Secretary.
No, how could that
be? We're very fortunate in this country not to have... But she thinks, because of her background in Ukraine and with Russia and all that, that actually you cannot trust the police. And anyway, she's an illegal immigrant. She thinks they'll hand her over. So she can't go to the police. Gary can't persuade her to go to the police. So you've got the Metropolitan Police actually embroiled in this
Did
as well as the FSB.
Did she not know what she was doing then?
Well, we don't want to give away the end, do we, Molly?
Well, it's just a big issue, isn't it? Like, does she or does she not know where she's putting, you know, poison in someone's
polonium or whatever it
may be? You can't reveal.
Not willing to answer that question. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay, well, everyone's going to have to read it to work it out.
He's taking the fifth.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's central to the whole.
Yeah, but I think the point, too, is that what's interesting to for me is that it has really a very exciting... conclusion. It builds to a really good conclusion. And it's a slightly unexpected, you know, this rather diffident man, Gary Nelson, and this illegal immigrant, and they get into all manner of scrapes and threats and all of that. And it's got great quality. That I like the characters, I like the plot development, I enjoyed the locale. Not sure about Gypsy Hill, but that's okay. It had a humanity, which I thought was very interesting. I read a lot of, quote, thrillers, which have got really no humanity. They're all about mechanics. It's all about, do we know what the XYZ is, or have you got the XYF? They're all about process, and they're not about character, which I thought you got very well. And I thought that worked. You wanted, you care about these
people, yeah. It's a funny thing. I just think that was a poncy thing when you heard writers. I mean, I've read fiction ever since I was a kid. You know, I've devoured fiction, including lots of crime fiction. But I always thought it was a bit poncy when you heard writers saying, well, this character took on a life of their own. And I just thought, really? But actually, it's quite... They do.
They do.
And I'm pleased what you said. I'll take you around the country with me, Jeffrey, to all my book festivals, because it was lovely what you said, because I thought it was really important... to build the foundations of the book by making the characters believable. If you make the characters believable and people are sympathetic to the ones they need to be sympathetic to, you can do unbelievable things with them and the readership will go with you.
That's absolutely true. The other thing that I think is definition of a good thriller is good villains. Yeah. Always. No story is any good at all unless it's got a really believable, strong villain. You've got to have a threat that makes a difference. And I've read quite a lot recently in which the threat really doesn't seem to be there. It's all kind of muddled, and you want Dr. No, you want Blofeld, you want someone that you can't forget.
And the good thing about the Russians, I think, as I say, I give an acknowledgement to a woman called Catherine Belton, who wrote a terrific book last year. I think it was published, called Putin's People, where she describes what Putin has done. I don't name Putin in there, but
I know you don't.
The president, the Russian president. What he's done to kind of mould together the FSB, which is the old KGB, which he was the leader in, with Russian organised crime, for the benefit of the Russian state. Now, as I say at the end of the book, if you read Catherine Belton's very well-received book, nothing I did in my imagination could be thought to be far-fetched compared with what is actually going on. I mean, you know, Salisbury happened 7 years after
Litvinenko.
After Litvinenko. And if you look at what's happened around the world with what Russians have done in to dissidents who have fled Russia, as well as the kind of, you know, the big money that has that followed the fall of the Berlin Wall. Yeah. So virtually all the stuff that was state-owned was privatized. These banks were created, and it was just a gold rush.
Yeah,
it was. Under Yeltsin, it was a gold. I've got a character in there who says, under Yeltsin, we swallowed so much freedom it almost choked us.
Yes.
When Putin comes in, he wants to drag that back, and he wants the Russian state to be respected again, part of which is being feared again, which it wasn't under Yeltsin.
Yeah,
and exactly. That is actually going on in this world today. So it was a handy kind of hook to hang the story on.
But that's why I think it's very timely. You know, Abramovich and many, many of the other oligarchs literally went to the Kremlin and gave Yeltsin money in suitcases, great big briefcases stuffed with dollars.
Yeah.
And that's how a lot of that whole extraordinary explosion of wealth began, because there was an opportunity.
Yeah.
But what I think is very nice about this, did you use any of your experience? I mean, or you haven't given away any secrets, I know that, but I mean, did you use any of your experience?
I was asked that question. I'm doing this the BBC Loose Ends thing tonight with Clive Anderson, which we recorded yesterday, so it's on tonight, and he asked me the same thing. And I said to him, Jeffrey. No, it's absolutely a good question. I could have written this if I'd never been Home Secretary.
There's
no state secrets.
No.
I mean, I can't. I'd be locked up in a tower if I released it. Oh, I'd have to clear the whole...
Well, you are a privy councillor, as
I am indeed. I have to, and I'd have to clear the whole book through, you know, cabinet office or something. So no, it's total fiction. But I suppose the relationship between MI5 and MI6, their relationship with the police, Metropolitan Police and all that, that was handy. Because it's noises off stage. It's not central to the book. But it's quite handy to know how that all works. Yeah. That's the only thing from my experience.
I think that's clear. Yeah. And the other thing, too, is I didn't think there was a moment's, indiscretion in this book at all.
No, it's just as well. The Irish Times, in their review, said something about, because I'd written this, I might now be a target for the Russians. So I've got to sniff my mineral water to check that there's no polonium.
I can see the Irish Times might say that, but then the Irish wouldn't they?
But why did you pick the Russian thing? Is that just a particular interest, or?
Well, that's what Litvinenko gave me the idea. What if the waitress had served? That was just the wrong. That's what started it. Yeah.
So is this the first of many?
Well, it's a two-book deal with Wildfire.
Wildfire.
Which are part of Hatchet.
Headline.
So it's a two-book deal. The second book has to have the same detective superintendent, Mangum, Louise Mangum, it's a woman. That was the only condition they made. So I'm, I'm past my deadline. I'm supposed to hand it in this month.
Oh, okay. So
I suppose that's what happens. No, it's 40,000 words in, so I've got, and it's halfway through. But my publisher's very understanding. Do you know of a writer that ever... I mean, did you ever hand your stuff in on time? I suppose you're more disciplined.
Absolutely. Have you met Jeffrey? Right. He absolutely hands everything in on time.
I'm not going to get paid. The work in. But it's a wonderful thing to be able to do, and a great tribute to you, and a great tribute to your humanity. And it is a fascinating example. We've got lots of... We've now got Frank Gardner, we've got Robert Peston, we've got all manner of
Bill
writers.
Clinton, you've got Bill Clinton, who's
Bill Clinton
said
and
to
Hillary next week with Lewis Funnell. All saying, "Oh, okay, I'm gonna go into fiction." It's a crowded field, dear.
Well, let me ask you this, Jeffrey, because this is, I mean, this world of crime fiction. I know this is about true life, true crime, crime con, but crime fiction is a world, you know, I'm becoming immersed in with the Harrogate Conference,
yes,
the Bloody Scotland one I did remotely last week, And there seems to me to be a comradeship amongst crime writers that I didn't find amongst other writers.
And crime fans.
And crime fans.
They're right.
And it seems, but it comes from, I think, a feeling that they're undervalued, that somehow
it's not
it'll never get a Booker. It'll never seen as, no, it's it'll never literature. Win a Nobel Prize for literature, which is totally unfair.
Very.
Given that, you know, Bleak House had Inspector Bucket.
Yes.
You know, Crime and Punishment. Dostoevsky is about, at the heart of it, is a murder.
Edgar
you know,
Allan Poe.
What's the difference between...
Edgar Allan Poe?
Yeah. How do you classify this? Oh, that's crime fiction, so we won't, you know, even consider that for a book of
Well, I've just finished John Banville's second...
The second I'm a great book. John Banville
The
man.
Snow.
I didn't realise he was a...
He was a Booker Prize winner.
Yeah.
And turned to writing crime fiction. The first one was called Snow, and the second one, which is called April in Spain, comes out very shortly. I'm reviewing it in a week or two's time. It's a most beautiful piece. I mean, if anything deserves to go onto a Booker long list,
it's that.
John does. Yeah. I mean, it is a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. Elegantly written, beautifully executed, wonderful characters with a great ending. You know,
because the book he won the Booker Prize for was The Sea, wasn't it? Wasn't a detective mystery story.
He took up detective stories with this book, Snow, last year, October last year. And this is the second. It's got a character, a detective inspector, Strafford, who is in both books, but he's really peripheral to the second.
Right.
It's all set in Ireland. Well, John would set it in Ireland, probably. It's all set in Ireland. It's a wonderful, elegant story about a man who happens to see a woman who he thought was dead in San Sebastian in Spain. And it all extends from there. I do heartily recommend it. It's called April in Spain. It's published by Faber and it's written by John Banville. But I wondered if we could get back a bit to the true crime.
Okay.
Just a tiny bit. I did a book called Pure Evil, which... asked a series of questions about how we deal with the worst of the worst. Now, you were Home Secretary after the time when you could extend someone's prison sentence. So that was David Blunkett, the last Home Secretary to do that, because then the judgment of the European Court of Human Rights and all of that, and then that was changed eventually by the Court of Appeal in England. But do you think we do it? Do you think we have the right system? I'm fascinated to know. Do you think... we do deter, or do you think it's just really haphazard?
I think it's more haphazard than what. But when I became Home Secretary, all that had been taken off of the Home Secretary. So you remember under John Reid,
yes,
he said the Home Office isn't fit for purpose.
I do.
And the feeling was it was dealing with so many things. It was dealing with counterterrorism. Mm-hmm. It was dealing with the police. It was dealing with immigration, and it was dealing with prisons. And it was dealing with the whole, I mean, you know, up until the 1970s, the Home Office ran every pub in Carlisle because they were nationalised in the First World War. It had a whole set, they were responsible for fox hunting, you know, when we banned fox hunting, that was a Home Office responsibility. So when I became Home Secretary and Jackie Smith before me, that had all gone to the Ministry of Justice. So I had nothing to do with prisons. I didn't have to worry about that. Why do I think it's haphazard? Well, because, you know, if you look at the reoffending rate, it's huge. You know that, so that process of which prison is a part of has to be about taking these people who have committed crimes and rehabilitating them so that when they come back into society, they should be able to take a place. Yeah, and what do we? I mean, you know, I think what David Blunkett was doing at the time with prison sentence was responding to a public concern.
Oh, it was.
That you know, people get off even a life sentence for horrific murders, you know, only means sort of 10 years at the most.
Well,
so the whole life sentences came in response to public concern, I think.
But I think one of the questions that occupies me, because I'm so concerned about, because I deal with it all the time, victims' families and, you know, what happens to the families. I mean, they are often destroyed by the events that over which they have no control at all. They are simply the victims of circumstance. Wrong place, wrong time, strange desires, whatever it may be. And maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm naive, but I always hoped that we as a society could find a way of deterring that kind of behaviour. But I don't, honestly, I know we haven't.
I want to go into a wider point than that, but it is related to that. You know, people were scratching their heads. How come crime halved between, just before we came into power? Michael Howard was the first one in 95. And then from 95 right through to 2010, crime just fell and fell and fell and fell. All of it. Violent crime fell dramatically. And my experience talking, it didn't just wasn't just in this country, by the way. It was in other countries as well. You'd think what New York was like in the 80s.
Absolutely.
You dare go down the subway. That was all transformed. When you talk to the police about this and the people involved in it, they say it is a wider issue than just what they're doing. It starts at school, in schools. They had this theory about domestic violence, the police. They told me that domestic violence, which was a no-go area for the police. When I was growing up in the 50s, in my own experience of my father beating up my mother,
yes,
the police would never want to interfere. That's a matter for the married couple between them or the, you know, the partner. And it was only when we started to crack down on domestic violence, the police said that was really, really significant, because violent men, you know, might start off knocking their wives or girlfriends or their kids
around,
then progresses. They become violent. They become dehumanized.
Also, they show violence to their children if they have them.
Yes, so and then that goes on. And, you know, they find they've become violent towards women as well. And it's a big issue now, you know, violence towards women and girls. And so this focus on domestic violence courts, refuge centres for women, changing the law to say that if a woman goes to the police and says, I've been attacked by my husband, they're not forced to go back and live. So that's what you used to say, right, go back home, we'll be in touch with you. It's the offender that has to leave home, not the offended against. All of that just disappeared. I mean, it's a partly political point in a sense, but, you know, police were cut by 25%. Their budget was cut by 25%. All that stuff they were doing in schools and on domestic violence got cut. And I think if we're ever going to get back to that, it's not just putting police numbers back in again. It's about the kind of things that you do from a very young age, to children of a very young age, to make sure they don't turn into their fathers. Mm. I mean, there is some violence from women against men, but not much of it.
Unfortunately, does happen. I did a thing this morning with Colin Sutton, DCI Colin Sutton, star of Manhunt, The Night Stalker, and Levi Belfield. I wrote a book about Belfield. I don't think Belfield would have been deterred for one second by whatever sentence it was. He knew that he wasn't going to pay with his life. In the end, he'll go to jail for the rest of his life. He's perfectly happy with that. He likes notoriety. He loves being Yusuf Karim, as he now is in jail. He isn't deterred. And yet he was a man who acted in the most extraordinary way. Random killing is a very rare event. And Mo and I have done a number of random killings in the podcast, and they're not common. Yeah. Usually you're attacked by somebody you know. Usually it's probably a relative or a lover or, you know, partner. But the random killers are absolutely impossible to put your finger on. And we were talking about Delroy Grant, the Night Stalker, that's a British Night Stalker. There are two American ones. And they couldn't solve it. I mean,
isn't that where contract killing comes in? Because they have no motive, no association, they're hired, paid.
Absolutely.
And that's why they're the most difficult to,
And paid for it. And they make a living out of it, and sometimes a very, very good living.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a very, very complex and delicate issue. I mean, I am concerned about what they now call sentence creep. You know, oh, well, we've got to be even tougher, so instead of a minimum term of 25 years, it's going to be 28, it's going to be 30, 32, 35. A lot of the men, and it's almost always men, are really, they like to be king of the walk in prison. You know, I'm in here for a lot of terrible crimes, and I wonder, are we doing the right thing, or is it, if we had a completely white blank sheet of paper, Alan, what would we do? What would you do? redraw.
Well, we're obviously not doing the right doing the right thing. Actually, the politician that really seemed to want to tackle it was Rory Stewart, who was a Conservative politician, and he made that rather kind of vainglorious statement: if we are still having the same reoffending rate in a year's time, I think he said
he did.
They ought to sack me as a minister.
Yeah,
they sacked him for other reasons before then, but he seemed to really want to grasp this nettle. Whether Dominic Raab will be the same, I don't know, because it needs root and branch.
I think that's the
changes.
Point.
What they do with them in prison, you know, I think what Chris Grayling, wasn't it, who banned them having books or something in prison libraries.
Daft.
I mean, that's not going to do anything to help.
I mean, I've acted as a consultant on a Netflix series recently on Nielsen, which I'm going to talk about later on today here. Des, really, in a way, was perfectly relaxed about, okay, I accept. How many people did he kill? Oh, maybe 16.
Do you think he also felt quite happy to be finally caught?
I think there are some people relieved. I think there is that sense that, there is that sense that, you know, if you committed that many extraordinary crimes, you want to...
Well, some serial killers say that about getting away with it. Like, Ed Kemper said that, like, he wouldn't have caught me. You know, or like we said about Bundy, like, oh, he just got caught by accident, like...
Yeah, well, it was...
They actually probably want to get... Not want to get caught, but, you know, it's not like they're thinking, oh, I'll go to prison.
John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah.
Classically, the killer clown, you know, buried them all under the house. Until he couldn't bury them under the house because there wasn't more room left and started throwing them in the river. And at that point, it all went wrong. But, you know, there is this... But the issue I wanted to raise with you, because why I think it's an interesting conversation, is there anything we as a society can do, or have we just gone too far down the wrong road? What do you think? I mean...
No, I don't accept this Council of Despair.
Okay.
Tony Blair tells a very good story in his memoir, The Journey, that when he... Because he was Shadow Home Secretary when John Major was in power. He said, tough on crime, tough on the causes.
The causes of crime.
Famously. But when he became Prime Minister, he got all his civil servants together and said, look, how do we get... how do we change this situation where people offend, serve a sentence, go back out and offend again? How do we tackle this crime, burgeoning crime? And as I say, under Michael Howard, it just started... I mean, it had gone up right through, ever since the Metropolitan Police were formed. Went right up through the First World War, right up through the 30s. Second World War, you know, all this idea everyone was cozy in their air raid shelters. Well, they were committing crimes, God, all over the place. It was a terrible time for crime. Went up through the 50s. And Tony was told, so Tony said, is it something to do with the economy? Like when there's lots of unemployment, there's crime. Civil servant said, yes, when unemployment's high, there's lots of crime because there are people who, you know...
Need to make a living.
And he said, so that means that crime will go down when there's full employment. No, civil servant said, when there's full employment, yet lots of crime goes up because it's acquisitive and lots of people have tellies and they buy things and people want to nick them. So Tony said, so what you're telling me is no matter what happens with the economy and what happens with unemployment and what happens in, that crime is always going to go up. Yes, they said. That was the Council of Despair. Crime will always go up. And of course, that, what I mentioned, halving crime.
Yes.
With a, you know, to recruit properly to the police and all the rest of it. But then you also have to pay attention to what you're talking about. What happens to people while they're serving their sentences? What happens to them? To the criminal justice system? How can you be assured that if you commit a crime, you're more likely to get caught than not caught? I mean, you know, the number of... What's the percentage of cases now where...
Tiny.
Even on serious crimes.
Tiny.
Serious violent crimes, tiny.
Yeah.
So I don't accept that Council of Despair.
But...
If you put the resources in...
Oh, so it's a question of resources.
That's partly a question of resources,
yeah.
You know, including in the prison system. I mean, I'd hate to be involved in the prison. I mean, what must it be like to be a prison officer at the moment?
Horrifying,
with this overcrowding. No one wants to say to the public, oh, we're investing money in prisons.
Well, I can remember vividly, Alan, being told by a politician, of course, there's not a single vote in prisons.
Yeah.
Don't even think about it.
Part of the problem, yeah.
And I can remember going to Wormwood Scrubs in 1966, 67. It was a horrifying experience, you know. It was a warehouse. It wasn't there was no rehabilitation, there was no exercise, there was no nothing. It was just,
yeah.
Well, let's lock them up and throw away the key, except we have to let them out at certain points. But the other thing I think is interesting, and it's a slight change of tangent, but not much. What do you think about the causes, particularly of serious violent crime? Where do you think those, are they just in the fact you've had a terrible upbringing and so why not, or you've just been a rebellious teenager and so why not nick another car or burglar a house or mug somebody, or
yeah.
Where, is it just economic, or is it, is there something in the criminal psyche?
I don't think it's just people from that kind of background are likely to end up like that.
Well, you could have ended up like that.
I could have ended up like that, yeah. I was lived very near Rillington Place, you know, Christie and all that, brought up in that area and through the Notting Hill race riots. But I think there is an issue there. We had something, I don't make it sound like everything we did was right and everything other governments did was wrong, but as you look into all this, you do see that things like, you know, people being literate, able to read.
Read and write.
Yeah, so ignorance is a big cause of crime. But there was also something called, which we didn't start, it was teachers themselves, the social and emotional aspects of learning, SEAL, the social and emotional aspects of learning, that you get kids quite young, 5, 6 years of age, and you work at how they interact with each other and how they resolve conflicts. Because you can insulate, as the Scandinavians have shown, and the Finns in particular, not Scandinavian, but that part of the world, that you can insulate kids against the terrible backgrounds they're born into if you put the effort into it and the resources into it. So I think that, you know, it starts very young in areas where, you know, you remember some years ago, some of these housing estates, 80s and 90s in particular, with kids running around on stolen cars and
BMX bikes.
BMX bikes in the papers every day. Well, you know, that stopped, that ended, because there was a concerted effort to do it.
You know,
street sleeping, people just sleeping out on the streets. And that ended.
Yeah.
It's back again now, but it ended. So this, the council has said you cannot do anything about that. You can, but you have to start.
At the beginning.
To start young.
Very
to
young.
Start at the beginning.
Yeah, I'm constantly fascinated by the issue of, you know, are you, if you're a, you turn into a serial killer, and I write a lot about serial killers, you know, are you, is it a gene? Is it nurture? Is it, you know, what?
Well, you two are the experts on
this. Yeah, absolutely not. Haven't figured it out 4 years of podcast later. Just got still no idea.
But it is an interesting question, you know, what, I mean, not everybody who has a terrible childhood turns into a serial killer.
No.
Not everybody who's a terrible childhood turns into a serial rapist or indeed a burglar or whatever else it may be. But some do, and it's very difficult to put your finger on why that is and what's changed.
Do you think it's equally difficult to pin down what would make someone successful, though? Just to, like, think about it the other way. Like, you take people from one background and, like, some may choose to push themselves forward and become a lawyer or a politician or something, and some may go the other way. It's equally difficult to pin that down, though.
But that's why you're such a good candidate, Alan. I mean, you did that. You took the right turning, so to speak.
Can I ask you a question about that, which is totally non-true crime related, so I'm really sorry, but I keep listening to the Radio 4 in the morning and I listen to all these politicians being interviewed and I just think, who would do this job? Like, I just don't understand why anyone would choose to be a politician. Like, it seems to me like the most stressful thing you could possibly choose to do, like, to make decisions for everybody. What prompted you to be like...
Thousands of people want to do it. You know, look how many people are standing for election.
I know.
I think it's worse now. It's worse now because of social media, really, I think, which has been advantageous in lots of ways. As has new technology, like DNA and all the things we were just talking about, CCTV, etc. Look, you know, it's a privilege to do it. It's not the toughest job I've ever done. I mean, try cycling.
But it's so responsible, though.
I think that's the Prime Minister's, which is a job I never wanted to do. I think Prime Minister's job is god-awful.
But still, if you're Home Secretary, that's like...
You're part of a team. You might get a rough ride on the Today programme, but... You know, if you know how to handle yourself, you'll get through it.
But you're making big decisions. If someone, but so do you think then that all of the big decisions, then you'll just be like, oh, well,
he's prime minister at the time, so or
you
she,
have collective
so that's
responsibility. You're part of, you know, I'd rather be a politician than a prison officer. I'd rather be a politician.
I don't think that's a real
yeah,
job.
Yeah, I was just saying there's not much comparison there.
I said there's worse jobs.
Oh, God, no,
don't
I appreciate
feel too sorry for them.
I don't. Right. I'm just interested as to what, yeah, it's yeah. so outside of my realm to think, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go and make responsible choices for the whole country.
Well, it's a shame, actually, it's wrong to hear you say that, because, you know, we shouldn't be turning people off, particularly young women, from going into politics.
I know, but then that's probably much sort of my personality, which might be similar to the why do some people become politicians and some become serial killers. Like, I would never become a politician.
But you might become a serial killer, is that right? Is that
still possible.
It's entirely possible.
There's still time. This is all just, like, really good research.
Yeah.
Yes, but, I mean, we're coming nearly to the end, and we always try and end on a more cheerful note. You know, one of the things we've done, because we do sometimes, we did a run of really terrible child killings. So we did about 8 podcasts.
In a row. It was awful.
And it got, you know, you just got so depressed and so brought down. And so we always try and end in, you know, sort of, let's talk about something jolly.
Something
cheery. So you obviously started on the second book, although you're not quite finished. What's beyond that? What are you planning beyond that?
Writing more.
More?
Books. Yeah, I'm into writing now.
Very good.
And the writing, you know, I've exhausted memoirs. I'm sick of writing about myself. So, and now that I've climbed the rock face with Late Train to Gypsy Hill, which, whether it does badly or whether it does well, is as good as I can do it. I feel I've succeeded in that sense. And so this is a 2-book deal. Hopefully there'll be more books to come after that.
Well, we hope so too, and I do think it's a cracking start in fiction. I've said
thank
so.
Thank you, Geoffrey. And I love your trainers as well. I mean, anyone listening who can't see Geoffrey, he is dressed impeccably.
Molly bought them from me.
Oh, I see.
I bought him some like this first, but white, and then I bought him those ones.
So you got to wear what your daughter bought you for Christmas.
Right, we won't mention the rest of what you're dressed in, Geoffrey.
But the other thing, Mo, is what you've got something good this week coming up?
I'm going on holiday.
Oh, you're on holiday?
Yeah.
Well, that's right, you're going to Greece.
Yeah.
Oh, crikey, that's brave.
I'm going to a place called Ouranopolis.
Where?
In Greece.
In Greece.
Because I've set my second book in Crete.
Oh, have you? Yeah, I'm not going to the islands, I'm going to, like, the mainland.
Ah, right, okay.
Like, yeah.
I hope it includes Dominic Raab.
Well, the sea was closed for Dominic, remember.
Are you Late Train to Gypsy Hill, are you proud of it?
Yes, I am.
Good. So you
I
should
am.
Be.
And even prouder since your review, Geoffrey. Thank you.
But genuinely, it's a cracking start.
Yeah.
It's a good read. It's something that leaves you with a bit of an uplift, which I think is a great... I read so many which end on a sort of, groan, you know, that are so sad. And it is, yes, it's got lovely qualities. And so
you felt all the strands had come together.
Yes,
at the end.
Absolutely.
The
and it is also, as you said quite rightly, a bit of a love story.
And what I like is all the red herrings you can put in there.
Yeah,
so I come from a world in politics where the biggest crime you can commit is to mislead people. Yeah, misleading the House, you can get suspended. Whereas if you're a mystery thriller writer, it's your duty to mislead people.
Yes, and people take a great deal
when
of
they
pleasure.
Get to the end. Oh, right.
They take a great deal of pleasure in it.
Absolutely, yes. Being misled.
Being misled. Yeah, no, they like to see, am I going to get out of this? I think that's a red herring.
Yeah.
I think there is, that's one of the joys of, you know, crime thrillers, that you are often taken for a little bit of a detour when actually you should keep your eye on the real story going through, which is an absolute delight. Well, Anne, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
It really has. Let me say thank you to all the people that help us. Thank you to the CrimeCon UK team for sorting us out today.
That's Neil
and doing,
at the back there.
Doing all, looking after everything, to our producer, Sam Brain, to my brother, Dan, who does the music, my friend, George, who do our caricature, to Alan, thank you so much for coming. It's been amazing. To Geoffrey, because you're Geoffrey. And to you, the audience, thank you so much for coming.
Thank
and
you
the
so
listeners.
Much for coming. And as I say at the end of every podcast, sadly, bad things happen to good people, so do be careful out there.